I strip down and wash off the mud, soaping up and rinsing quickly because I'm anxious to check on Bryn. I'm sure she's asleep, but I'll feel better when I see her chest rising and falling easily under Mama's quilt. Slipping naked back into the house, I race through the living room and down the hallway, to my room. I throw on clean jeans and a t-shirt, then head back to Mama's room. I know something is wrong, very wrong, right away. Bryn's been living with me for 4 days now, and I know she doesn't talk in her sleep, but as I approach her room, I hear her mumbling. "Jem, Jem, oh, no," she mutters, her voice breathless with panic, breaking on tears. Pushing open the curtain, I find her in bed lying on her back, but her face is bright red, and the hair around her face is damp, sticking to her glistening skin. "No," I mutter, lurching forward to press my hand to her forehead. "Shoot, no." Her skin is hot, so hot, scary hot.
"Jem," she says, opening her heavy eyes, "I should have been there."
"I'm getting you a cold cloth," I say, leaving her to run to the bathroom. I grab a hand towel and douse it in cold water, then hurry back to Bryn. I shouldn't have left her. Damnation, I shouldn't have left her. Kneeling beside her bed, I press the towel to her forehead. One of her wounds must be infected. I need to take a look at them, then get some ibuprofen into her to fight the fever.
"Jem,"
she mutters as her eyes flutter closed.
"My battery. Oh, no."
I don't know who Jem is, but the profound sadness in her voice makes my insides clench with sympathy. Her voice sounds like mine after I lost Mama. Bereft. Lost. Alone. "Bryn," I say gently, close to her ear. "It's Cassidy. You're safe. You're not alone. I'm looking after you, remember?"
"Jem,"
she sobs softly as tears trickle down her cheeks. Leaving the icy compress on her forehead, I run to the kitchen and open the cabinet over the refrigerator, where I keep medical supplies in a plastic tackle box. I grab it and place it on the counter. I'm going to need to boil water, too, which I generally do in the fireplace or outside, over the fire pit, but I don't have time to make a fire. I decide to use the propane stove instead. It'll use a lot of gas to get the water hot enough, but I don't care. I'll go back to the Golden Bridge store next week to stock up on more propane if I have to. I fill a pot with water, place it on the stove, and ignite the burner. Uncertain of whether or not she'll be able to swallow pills, I crush 4 ibuprofen tablets between 2 spoons and mix them with goat's milk. When I return to Bryn, I prop up her head and give her the milk, which she, blessedly, drinks without issue. Then I pull down the covers and lift her t-shirt to take a look at her incisions. I see the problem immediately. Around one of her many bandages is an angry-looking redness, and seeping through the bandage is a yellowish-brown discharge. I lean closer. It smells off, too. "It hurts, but I'm okay." Why didn't she say something this morning? She had to have been uncomfortable. Maybe the Percocet masked the pain? No, I'm only giving her half doses. Maybe she was trying to be brave by not saying anything. "She's your responsibility, Cassidy. How did you miss this?" And then I realize I fell asleep beside Bryn last night before changing the dressings, and I was so distracted by my attraction to her this morning, I raced out of the cabin before I could tend to her. She's had the same dressing on for almost 24 hours, when it should have been flushed and disinfected last night or this morning. I'm lucky more of them haven't soured. By fighting against my feelings like a self-centered, self-absorbed teenager, I've put her in danger. "That stops now," I tell myself. "You put her first, you take care of her. If you develop feelings for her, so be it. You can undevelop them later, once she's gone. But as long as she's under your roof, she comes first, Cass. You hear?" Furious with myself, I take the compress from her head, run to the bathroom to re-soak it in cold water, and replace it on her forehead before checking on the boiling water. If the sutures have to be removed and the wound flushed with saline and re-sewn, I'll have to sterilize any instruments I need to use, including a syringe. She's going to need a shot of lidocaine before I do anything. When I return to her side, she's mumbling about Jem again. Jem? Who is Jem? I squat down beside her. Shh, I whisper. Bryn, listen to me. You're going to be okay. You've got a little infection, and it started a fever. I'm sorry I wasn't here. I promise I'll make it better.
Jem, I'm sorry, she murmurs.
Then so softly, I almost miss it.
Cass?
My heart stutters and my breath catches as I stare at her face, at the tan freckles against her red skin. She has remembered me, even in her feverish state, and it makes something happen inside me. Something that I've never felt before rips through me at the speed of light. It is strong and true and heavy in such a good light way that for a moment I feel like I could float away from the force of it. My lungs burn as I suck in a deep breath. My eyes water and I blink them rapidly. I vow that I will never, ever let anyone hurt this woman again. Not Jem, not Wayne, not anyone. And definitely not me. Bryn, I say, my voice gravelly and shaking with emotion as I reach up and adjust the cloth on her forehead. I thread my fingers through her hair, smoothing it away from her hot face. I'm here. I'm here with you.
Cass,
she sighs, drawing out the S in my name until it's just breath. I can hear the water boiling, so I return to the kitchen and put two needles, a spool of fishing line, a syringe, scissors, tweezers, and several cloths into the water. Then I bring it all, along with the medical box, back into Bryn's room. I've known the devil in my lifetime. I'm fairly certain that a part of him still lives inside me. But I'll gladly do battle with him now to make her well again.
Chapter 17. Bryn. I'm so sorry, Miss Cadogan, but we need to speak to you. Is there a Jeremiah Benton residing at this address? Can we come in? Can you sit down, miss? A band called Steeple 10 was playing tonight at the... We regret to tell you that Mr. Benton... Is there someone we can call for you? Miss Cadogan? Miss Cadogan? Miss... Why my brain forces me back to that night, I don't know. I wish it didn't. There are so many other times of my life I'd rather revisit, but this one always seems to win out. The well-intentioned female detective, the male officer in his dark blue uniform with a seven-sided star over his heart, the black and white squad car outside on the street in front of our house, blue and red lights swirling, painting garish shadows on the walls. But breaking through my memories, I hear another voice telling me that I'm safe, that I'm not alone, that I'm going to be okay. It's new, but I trust it. It's like the voice of God breaking through the cold, dark hell of my worst nightmares, and suddenly I am warm again. I am so warm. Should I be this warm, Cassidy? Cassidy. Cass. In my mind, I search for the face that matches the voice, and I see a clear stream with a blue stone and a green stone sitting side by side, glistening on the sand just beneath the still water. I'm here. I'm here with you. Cass, I whisper, my voice light years away. Help. Oh, Cass, please help. There is a soft ripping sound, like someone pulling tape from skin. Under the sound of my scream, I hear him groan. Something's wrong. I open my eyes, and his face is turned away from me, but his unkempt blonde hair is familiar, and it comforts me. Cass, I murmur. Help. He turns to me, those glistening stones blinking at me.
I will, Angel. I promise. He exhales. This is going to pinch.
I cry out as I feel a fresh stab of pain in my hip near the burning.
That was lidocaine, he whispers, wincing like it hurt him too. It'll numb up the area. I have to take out the stitches, flush it, and re-sew it.
I close my eyes and try to breathe through the pain.
I'm sorry, Bryn. It got infected, but I'll fix it, I promise. Won't take long, a few minutes.
But in reality, it takes only a few seconds, because, thank the Lord and baby Jesus, I pass out from the pain. If I trust in you, oh, please, don't run and hide. He's singing the Beatles to me again. I open my eyes and find Cassidy in the rocking chair on the other side of the end table, guitar in his lap, fingers gently strumming, eyes closed, lips moving softly. Cass? His hands freeze, his eyes open and slide to mine.
You're awake.
I nod. Can I have some water?
Yep.
He places his guitar on the floor, reaches for a glass on the end table, and holds it to my lips as I lean up to drink. When I'm finished, he puts the glass back down and squats beside my bed.
How you feeling, Bryn?
Like I've been through something, I mutter, letting my head fall back on the pillow. What happened?
One of your incisions got infected,
he says, his eyes heavy. He grimaces, looking down at the mattress between us.
I had to open it, clean it, and re-suture it.
It doesn't hurt, I say, surprised to find I'm telling the truth. I don't feel it. I don't feel much of anything, in fact.
I gave you a full Percocet,
he says. Percocet is a weird and funny word, I think, trying to focus my eyes on his face. Cass?
Hmm?
Are you a doctor?
No, but I'm as good as a certified paramedic.
As good as? I ask, turning my head slightly to look at him. The movement is sluggish, like my head's encased in molasses.
I studied hard and took all the tests. I mean, I took them here from the back of a textbook, but I did good. I would have aced them in a classroom.
Your eyes are different colors, I note aloud. His lips twitch like he wants to laugh, but doesn't.
Yes, they are.
Cocking his head to the side, he stares at me hard, like he's trying to figure something out. What? I ask, working hard to keep my eyes open. Ask. He clenches his jaw, and I don't see his hand reach up, but I feel it resting gently on my forehead, and I don't mind that he's touching me.
You're cooler.
Is that what you wanted to ask?
Don't do that again,
he blurts out in a rush. Do what?
Be sick.
He looks away, his jaw clenched and tight.
You scared me.
You called me Angel, I say sleepily, my eyes starting to close. When did he call me Angel? I can't remember. His head jerks up and his breath catches. I hear it. I hear it catch. It's okay, I say on an exhaled breath, closing my eyes because I am just too damn tired to keep them open anymore. I don't care if you call me Angel.
Bryn,
he says.
I shouldn't have left you. I should have been here. I'm sorry. I'm so dang sorry.
I was hot, I mumble. Scared. Jem.
I'm sorry.
Hold me, I whisper. While I sleep. I am drifting off, but I don't surrender until I feel the mattress dip under his weight and his body slide onto the bed next to mine. One arm slips under my pillow. The other falls gently just under my breasts.
Good night, Angel,
he murmurs. I breathe in the smell of Cassidy, and then I sleep. When I wake up, the sun is rising through the windows, and Cassidy is lying beside me. He's on his right side facing me while I'm on my back. But in my sleep, I have turned my neck to face him, our noses almost touching. It's warm and intimate, and I am fully aware that we don't know each other very well, but it doesn't feel like that. I feel like I trust him, like I need him, like I want him. Not sexually, although he is definitely a hot-looking guy, but viscerally, like for survival. He has become my lifeline, and without him, I would have died too many times to count. Suddenly, I have this existential notion that there can't be a me without a Cassidy. This thought isn't romantic or poetic, it just is. But it's solid and real, and I don't mentally recoil from it. In fact, I lean into it. There is no me without you. And it's not like anything I've ever felt before. Unfortunately, I can't lie beside him and savor the feeling because my bladder is full again. Cass, I say. He mumbles. Cass, I have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, okay.
I lean back a little so I can look up into his face and his eyes open slowly.
Angel,
he breathes, his eyes slowly focusing on mine. Angel? I hear myself chuckle softly. No angels here, just me. Bryn. His eyes snap open now, fully aware, fully awake.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry, I just...
The bathroom? I prompt. He rolls to his back, swings his legs over the side of the bed, and stands up. He rakes a hand through his hair, then offers me his hand. I sit up and take it, surprised that the pain in my left hip is less than it was yesterday morning. Not that I feel great, but I don't hurt like the devil anymore. I feel better, I say, sitting on the side of the bed for a moment, bracing for the pain I'll undoubtedly feel when I stand up.
5 of your incisions are looking really good. 1's a problem, child. I need to take a look at it after you... go.
I nod. Okay. Today, I move to the bathroom a little faster, and it's not as strange to me as it was yesterday. I lower myself carefully to the toilet seat, remembering that I don't need to flush when I get up. As I am washing my hands in the sink, I look up at my face. It's still battered, and maybe I'm just used to it now, but I think it looks better than it did yesterday morning. Good night, Angel. The words hum through my head. When he called me Angel a few minutes ago, I assumed it was part of a dream he was having. But now I wonder, did he call me that on purpose? Cassidy, I call as I open the bathroom door, but there's no need. He's in the hallway across from the bathroom door waiting for me.
I'm here.
What exactly happened yesterday? I realize that there's a sizable gap in my memory, but during that time, apparently, I was given a pet name. Angel. But when? How did I earn it? What did I do? What did he do?
What do you remember?
I lean against the wall in the dim hallway, staring up at him. He's wearing jeans and a t-shirt, and I'm wearing his dead mother's underpants and t-shirt. It should make me uncomfortable, since we barely know each other, but it doesn't. It doesn't bother me at all. I cut to the chase. Why are you calling me Angel? His eyes widen and his cheeks flush.
You said... I mean...
He rakes his hands through his hair. Here's what I remember. We had eggs, then you offered me some books while you went to the store. I say slowly, trying to create a timeline. I was reading one, and then...
And then?
I finish quickly. And then we wake up together, and you're calling me Angel. He sighs, dragging his bottom lip between his teeth before releasing it.
You had a fever yesterday. A really bad one. When I came home from the store, you were burning up.
Jem, I'm sorry. Fuzzy memories start bobbing up from my subconscious. Intense heat, memories of Jem, Cassidy taking care of me. I was pretty out of it.
You were. The fever didn't break until after midnight.
I don't remember much. What was I doing?
You were talking about someone named Jem when I got here. Upset. You had an infection. I had to open one of the incisions, clean it, flush it, and re-sew it.
My God. I am not uncomfortable that Cassidy tended to me, because he's given me no reason not to trust him, but I really don't like not being able to remember. Are you a doctor? His lips twitched.
You asked me that last night. The answer is no. I'm sort of a paramedic.
Sort of?
He grins.
You asked me that last night, too.
And? He grimaces.
I'm not actually certified, but I took the test and aced it.
Another strange Cassidy-ism. I'm starting to get used to them. Huh. Okay, so I was feverish and out of it, and you fixed me up. Again. He shrugs, but nods, still standing across from me in the hallway. I suddenly realize that this is the longest I have been out of bed in days. It feels good, too. The pain in my hip is achy, but not sharp and burning like yesterday. It's a dull and constant throb, and I know instinctively that this is good news, not bad. I'm healing. Thank you, I say.
I shouldn't have left you,
he says, frowning at me, his gaze intense.
I won't do that again, I promise.
His eyes, so intriguing, nail mine, and I feel the gravitas of his promise meet my body like something actual, like something physical. It makes me so aware of him, I backtrack on my earlier thought about not wanting him sexually. I think maybe I do. It's okay, I say, my voice a little breathless.
It isn't okay,
he insists.
You're my patient, my guest. I should have been here for you.
I take a deep breath and can feel some of my stitches pull a little. Seriously? You were doing me a favor. Stop beating yourself up. He looks down at his bare feet, eyebrows furrowed, lips straight and thin. Cassidy, I say sharply. He looks up at me. You saved me. Again. Thank you. He gulps, staring at me hard before nodding.
I'll do better, Bryn. I promise.
I'm about to say that he's already doing great, but I sense we'll just keep going around in circles, so I don't. Speaking of circles, as much as I like being out of bed, I'm starting to feel a little dizzy now. I think I better get back to bed.
Do you need help?
No, I say, starting back down the hall toward the bedroom. I'm good.
Want half a Percocet?
I shake my head, blaming part of my memory lapse on the strong painkiller. I think I'll tough it out from now on, okay? I don't like being out of it.
Bryn,
he calls to me, just as I'm about to turn the corner. I stop to face him. He's still standing across from the open bathroom door.
You asked me a question.
He takes a few steps toward me, his bare feet silent on the carpeted floor. I try not to check him out, but the way his jeans are slung low on his hips almost gives me the shivers. He's tall and lean and muscular, beautiful in a messy way, and I don't know if this is some sort of fucked up Florence Nightingale-style crush on him because he's taking care of me, or if it's more, but my heart skips a beat. And my stomach fills with butterflies.
I called you Angel at one point last night,
he says softly, like he's confessing something to me.
I don't know why. I was about to give you a shot of lidocaine, and I knew it would hurt. I called you Angel just before I stuck you.
I don't have a memory of this, but it feels right, sounds right. I don't care if you call me Angel, I say softly. He grins at me, thoughtfully, and I feel my whole body warm up in reaction to the small smile.
That's what you said last night,
he says, lightly. I did, he nods.
And just so you know, I was in your bed because you asked me to hold you.
I don't remember asking him to do this, either, but I know it's true. Not just because I trust Cassidy to tell me the truth, but because there is something so natural, so nice, so potentially addictive about sleeping beside him that I long for it even now, after a whole night spent together. Thank you, I whisper. His eyes are forest green and navy blue when he nods at me slowly. I turn back to my room and crawl into bed, leaving the curtain open and wishing he was next to me as I close my eyes
and fall back to sleep.
Chapter 18. Cassidy. After I make Bryn some toast with butter, sugar, and cinnamon, I spend the morning outside, milking Annie and mucking out her stable, and collecting eggs from the girls and vegetables from the greenhouse. I spray organic pesticide on the indoor plants and change out the tray in the composting toilet, dumping what's been cultivated about a quarter mile from the house in the fertilizer heap. I decide to leave wood chopping, cistern filter changing and treating, and solar panel cleaning for the afternoon. At about noon, I head back inside to make some lunch and check on Bryn. The curtain to her room is open, which must be her doing, since I've been careful to leave it closed, and I peek in to find her sitting up and reading Then Came You by Lisa Kleypas. Like most of the other books in the house, I've read it at least a dozen times, and though I prefer science fiction and fantasy to romance, it's among the better choices in Mama's old love story collection, which is why I offered it to Bryn. Well, that, and because there is a quote in the book that I should keep in mind while Bryn is visiting. Sooner or later, everyone was driven to love someone they could never have. A good reminder, especially since my thoughts are increasingly, heck, constantly, of Bryn. And my feelings for her, growing exponentially. After last night's fever scare, I know that losing her will hurt. When she returns to the world, I will grieve the loss of my angel. And you know what? So be it. All morning I have more or less resigned myself to that fate. I'll have a lifetime to get over her once she goes. I'm determined to enjoy her, her company, her smiles, her occasional chuckles, her warm body sleeping beside mine, while she's here. Although, if I am honest, my warm and happy feelings for Bryn are compromised by another, darker feeling that I haven't known in a long, long time. Jealousy. And one question has circled relentlessly in my head since yesterday. Who is Jem?
Hi. Oh, I stutter. Hi. How long have you been there?
Just a minute. Came in to check on you. She holds up the book, then grins at me.
I like this one.
Me too.
Wait, what?
She smiles so wide I wonder if it hurts her healing lip.
You read this?
I shrug. When you live out here, you read everything you can. 5, 6, 7, 20 times.
Huh, she says, still grinning. It's good. He wants to marry her.
I cross my arms over my chest. Should she marry him?
I don't know yet.
She looks back down at the book.
I mean, I know she will because they're the main characters, but I don't know. I'm not sure they'd be good for each other yet. She's wild and crazy, he's...
What?
Will he be happy with a wild woman? Or does he want some prim society girl?
I guess you'll just have to see what happens.
I guess so.
I am so curious about Jem. I use this moment of speaking loosely about fictional relationships to try to figure out who he is. Were you ever married?
No,
she says softly, her smile quickly fading. Part of me feels like I should apologize and slink away for violating her privacy, but my jealousy, hot and low in my stomach, boils up, refusing to back down. I want to know. I need to know who he is, and if he has a claim on her. Who's Jem? Her eyes widen and she takes a soft, jerking breath.
What?
You mentioned his name yesterday when you were... out of it. She nods distractedly, still staring at my face with sad, surprised eyes.
Oh, right.
My arms are still crossed over my chest, and though I don't take pleasure in her distress, it's the collateral damage of assuaging my curiosity and therefore jealousy. Negative emotions like envy, anger, and greed frighten me, because I feel sure that the 7 deadly sins are even deadlier for someone like me, who has the blood of a murderer in his veins. Part of being Cassidy Porter means handling such feelings head-on and quickly, lest they become a gateway for behavior. I won't let them fester. I won't let them guide me into darkness if I can help it. Realizing that I'm patiently waiting for an answer, she furrows her eyebrows, then says,
I was engaged to Jem, but he died. Later, I will feel ashamed of the sharp relief I feel at hearing her words, but for now, I let that relief cover me like a blanket, soothing the beast within me. I uncross my arms and clear my throat. I'm sorry for your loss. She nods, reaching up to swipe at her eyes, which I now notice are glistening. He was a good man. He was from here, Maine, Bangor, but we met in California. How long ago did he? 2 years, she says, sniffling, then offering me a brave smile. He was shot. He was at a concert. He was caught in one of those mass shootings. Mass shootings? I've never heard of such a thing. She takes a deep breath. It's when, someone goes to a crowded place and shoots a bunch of people. That's called a mass shooting. She exhales slowly, like she's forcing herself to let go of memories that hurt worse than any of her healing injuries. I lost him. My shame doubles as I realize I have forced her to talk about something incredibly painful just to satisfy my jealousy. Before now, I have never heard of a mass shooting. But for me, with only history as context, it conjures images of Nazi soldiers firing on innocent people wearing yellow stars pinned to their coats. The mental image horrifies me. When I search her face, I see that same elapsed horror in her eyes. She has had to come to terms with this mass shooting concept. Something so unspeakable, it should be impossible. My heart aches for what she has endured. God, Bryn, I'm really, really sorry. She gives me another brave smile and nods. He was a good person. I'm sure he was, if you loved him. I did love him, she says softly. I didn't want to live for a while after I lost him. I lost my mother to cancer, I hear myself saying. I was close to her. It was awful. How long ago? 13 years, I say, though the number surprises me because it feels much more recent. How old were you? 14. She winces and a small sound of pain escapes her lips. Leaning to her left, she places the book on the bedside table, then reaches her hands out to me. Gramp wasn't much for grieving. He loved my mother, and I know it hurt him to lose her, but he poured his grief into work, keeping busy and exhausting himself before bed every night. Me? I had no one to talk to, no one to hold me or let me cry about the parent I'd lost. Except now. Now, here is this angel woman holding out her hands to me in sympathy and compassion. I take them in mine, lowering myself to the bed beside her, drinking in the soft kindness of her eyes as she squeezes my hands. I'm sorry, she says. You were so young. I can't imagine losing my parents. They were everything to me after I lost Jem. She gasps softly. Hey, did you manage to call them? Your folks? Yeah, I left a message. I said you'd been injured, but you were okay, and you'd call them when you could. You're very kind, Cass. She breathes deeply and nods, still holding my hands. Your mom must have been amazing. She's always been there for you, son. Gramps' words from our talk in the greenhouse come back to me so fast, you'd think he just said them yesterday. She was, I say, wondering how bad it must have gotten for her in those years after my father's arrest and conviction. She never really talked about it, but it must have been hell. She would have been a pariah, and yet she protected me the very best she could. You okay? Asks Bryn, her voice gentle. I look up at her and nod. I don't talk about her much. I know, says Bryn. It's sad, and it hurts. I nod, amazed by her empathy, by her ability to understand how I'm feeling. Somehow it lessens the sadness in that moment, and the pain. As I look into her eyes, she smiles back at me, and the miracle of it is that it's possible I might be doing the same for her. That by sharing our pain with each other, we aren't doubling it, but having it. You know, she says, squeezing my hands again, he would have loved it here. Jem, She turns to the windows and looks out at the mountain. Oh man, he would have really loved this place.
Yeah?
He loved Katahdin.
She sighs softly, facing me. Her eyes drop to our joined hands, and she gently untangles hers from mine, pulling them away.
Can I tell you something?
Sure, anything.
The whole reason I was here was to bury his cell phone on the mountain. About a week ago, I took it out of an evidence bag for the first time, and I realized it had a smudge of blood on it. I came here to bury that small part of jam up on Katahdin. I thought I should do that.
That's what you were doing, when you were attacked. And suddenly I realized that last night wasn't the first time I heard Jem's name. I remember the first time I saw her, the way her friends kept asking her to turn back with them, and the way she kept refusing.
I wish I could, but this is something I need to do. I'm coming, Jem. I'm coming.
You were burying him, I whisper, running a hand through my hair as the pieces come together.
Sort of,
she says, unaware that I'd been watching.
His body was already buried, of course, but I don't know. I guess I just wanted to say goodbye in my own way.
I think of Mama and Grant buried side by side by Harrington Pond, and I understand exactly what she's saying. Saying goodbye to those we've loved and lost isn't just about burying them, but also about having a special place to remember them. Bryn wanted that place to be Katahdin.
The phone was in my backpack, she says. Didn't work out the way I hoped it would.
And now I understand completely. She wanted to bury her fiancé on Katahdin, and the chance to make that happen had been stolen from her. I feel anger bubble up inside me. She should have been able to say goodbye to this gem, who meant so much to her, who was taken from her so brutally. Instead, she herself was attacked while pursuing that end. My rage toward her attacker intensifies by the second until I'm practically shaking with it.
Cass, she says, cocking her head and looking at me curiously. You okay?
I jerk my head in a nod. I need to get control of myself. An emotion like anger stewing inside my body is no good for anyone. Want lunch? I ask gruffly. She nods and I stand up, looking out the windows at Katahdin's jagged peaks. Don't sit on your anger, Cassidy. Don't let rage manifest inside you. First chance I get, I'm going back up there for that phone so that Bryn can finish what she started. Bryn's fever hasn't returned, and I've made it a priority to flush and redress her wounds every 12 hours. Though she still sleeps for long stretches, she's definitely on the road to recovery now. I figure I'll be able to remove the stitches in another week or so. We'll see. Because she likes the company, most nights after dinner, I read in the rocker in her room while she reads in bed. Occasionally we share some funny bit of writing with each other, or some pretty turn of phrase. I've come to treasure these quiet moments together, reluctantly leaving her around midnight, once she's fast asleep, and the uncomfortable spindles on the back of the wooden rocker start digging into my spine. She hasn't asked me to hold her while she sleeps again, though I silently long for the words, willing them to issue from her lips night after night. I don't know what it is I want from her. I don't allow my mind to wander to carnality, but have to fight against it heading there on its own. I've never been with a woman, of course. I've never even kissed a woman. And despite those old magazines from Gramp, I'm not totally certain I'd even know what the hell I was doing, given a chance. But I'm a man, not a child, and I can't help my longings. When I head back to my cold, dark room after a warm evening in hers, it feels punitive somehow, much lonelier than it actually is. An ache rises up, and I have to fight the desperateness of my yearning to be near her. It's a certain kind of torture, but I wouldn't trade this time with her. Not for anything. I have a terrible feeling that these moments will be all I have one day, so I am very careful not to jeopardize them. This evening, however, I'm not headed back to my room. After I pull Bryn's covers up to her chin and dim the light in her room, I put on my hiking boots and grab Gramps' old miner's helmet from the closet in my room,
placing it on my head. I fish his watch from the back of my underwear drawer and slip it onto my wrist, grateful that it winds, because I wouldn't have the slightest clue how to get my hands on a watch battery. I set it to the correct time, then head quietly out of my room. There is a closet in the hallway, and I open it. Inside are three rifles, mine from childhood, Mama's, and Gramps, all of them oiled and ready. I take out Gramps, which is the only one made for a full-size man, and sling it over my shoulder. It's unlikely that I'll need it, but I'll be in the dark forest, and Baxter Park has a good share of wildlife. Night hiking has its risks. I look in on Bryn one more time, fairly certain that she'll be asleep for the next 6 to 7 hours. But just in case, I write out a note. Went for a night hike, back by dawn. Cass. I leave it on her bedside table, then take a long look at her. Her chest rises and falls easily, and her closed lids flutter in the throes of REM sleep. She's peaceful, and I haven't a second to waste if I want to be back by sunrise. Sweet dreams, Angel, I whisper, backing away silently from her bedside. The last time I left her, she was in bad shape when I came back, but I know she's healing now. I don't have to worry about her fever coming back, and I know she sleeps pretty soundly once she's asleep for the night. No tossing and turning. No waking up at 3 a.m. Besides, I need to do this for her. And for me. Letting that rage sit and simmer isn't smart. And the only way to mitigate it is to do something about it. Something real. Something good. I take a deep breath and sigh, hoping her backpack is still there to be recovered, and knowing it's going to be a long night.
Chapter 19. Bryn. When I wake up, the first thing I do is check for Cassidy in the rocking chair. But he's not there, and the house is quiet. The sun is higher than usual, so I'm assuming it's about 7 o'clock, but I don't smell coffee brewing or eggs frying. Stretching my arms over my head, I take a quick inventory of my body. Face? Not hurting at all anymore. Hip? Not hurting as much, though a dull ache persists. Gingerly, I sit up and swing my legs over the side of the bed. Bracing my hands on the mattress, I lift my body, wincing a little at the pain. I know how to move around now to keep my discomfort at a minimum, but big movements, especially standing up or sitting down, still hurt. As I steady myself for a moment, I realize there's a note on the bedside table. I pick it up. Cassidy went out last night. But it's well past dawn, and I don't think he's home yet. Cass? I call. Nothing. I walk to the doorway and call again, a little louder. Cassidy! Not a peep. Trying not to blow his absence out of proportion, he is entitled to his freedom, after all. I make my way to the bathroom, pee, wash my hands and face, and walk back into the living room. Up to now, I've always just returned to bed after using the toilet, but the house is so still, I pause in the living room, looking around. Over the couch, the portrait of Cassidy and his parents is gone, as are any other framed pictures, which I find curious. He must be really protective of his past, and I tell myself not to pry, no matter how much I want to. Taking a few steps into the room, I pass by the coffee table and check out the books lining the three long shelves under the picture window, starting at the far left and scanning to the right. The top shelf is nothing but books on biology. Your DNA and you. The DNA files. Heredity and genes. Tracing your genealogy. The DNA challenge. Nature versus nurture. The eternal showdown. The secret of life. Untangling your genetic code, and on. A whole shelf, maybe 12 feet long, with every book on genetics that you could possibly imagine. Are these Cassidy's books? His mother's? His father's? Was one of them a doctor, or a geneticist? I let my eyes drop to the next shelf, which is just as long and packed with books, but this time it's all fiction. Romance is on the left, with a small space open where three books, no doubt the three in my room, are missing. Science fiction, fantasy, general fiction. The shelf ends with a collection of hardcover books by John Irving, including my favorite, A Prayer for Owen Meany. Reaching forward, I take it from the shelf, flipping through the worn, dog-eared pages. There is so much wisdom, so many beloved, quotable lines in this book. I hold it against my chest, determined to read it again. The bottom shelf is not as organized as the top two. It's covered with a mix of genres, some poetry and hiking books, a few old farmer's almanacs, and half a dozen books about Maine. And at the far end, there is a collection of video cassettes in puffy plastic boxes. When I was little, we had a VCR, and I had all the Disney princess movies in similar boxes. I check out Cassidy's small collection, wondering which is his favorite. One of mine, The Sandlot, sits on the very end. I tug it from its place, flipping it over to read the back of the box. But tucked between the clear plastic covering and the back cover beneath is a faded newspaper photo. The caption reads, 7-year-old Cassidy Porter, son of Rosemary and Paul Porter of Millinocket, Maine, is carried on the shoulders of his teammates after he hits the winning run, leading the Millinocket Majors to the Maine State Little League playoffs. I tilt my head, drawing the box closer, looking at the face of the little boy raised high above the heads of the others. He is smiling joyfully, arms over his head in triumph. He seems well-liked by the other kids in the photo, which contradicts my possible theory that Cassidy lives out here because he suffers from social anxiety or awkwardness. So why does he live out here? I wonder for the umpteenth time. Why does he keep himself so isolated from society, from the rest of the world? What is he hiding from, or running from, or... Wait. I think about my words. Why does he keep himself so isolated? What is he hiding from? I've been assuming that Cassidy moved here on his own. He told me this was his grandfather's place, and for whatever reason, my mind decided that he inherited it as an adult and moved here. But now I back up in my mental process, piecing together what I know to create a timeline of Cassidy's life. First, there was the portrait that Cassidy removed. I recall that it was taken in 1995 when he was 5. It was of him, his mother, and his much older father. Second, there is the photo of his Little League triumph when he was 7, and the caption mentions his parents living in Millinocket, so they hadn't moved here yet. Third, I know that Cassidy's mother died 13 years ago when Cassidy was 14. Since I'm staying in her room and wearing some of her clothes, I think I can safely assume she lived here when she passed away. So he didn't move here as an adult. He moved here when he was still a child, sometime between the ages of 7 and 14, probably with his parents, but definitely with his mother. Which means Cassidy wasn't the one who chose this lifestyle. He just chose to stay. Still hugging A Prayer for Owen Meany to my chest, I turn away from the books and head back to my room, wondering why he never returned to the world. And wondering why his mother left it. I am on chapter 4 when I hear the front door open and close, and I'm surprised by the shot of adrenaline I get. I'm so happy, I feel like a firefly at dusk, bright from the inside. Cassidy's home. I hear him place something on the coffee table in the living room before appearing in my doorway, his body covered with dust and dirt, a mining helmet on his head.
You're awake, he says.
I am. You're back.
I am,
he answers grimly. How was your hike? He sighs.
Okay, I guess.
What's the benefit? I ask.
Of what?
Hiking at night?
It's quiet. Peaceful. I don't know.
He shrugs off the question, looking irritated.
How are you feeling?
Fine. Better every day. But he seems out of sorts. Everything okay with you?
I need a shower, he says, turning away. Then I'll make you some breakfast.
I'm feeling better. Really, I can help.
Don't worry about it,
he says over his shoulder, already walking away. I watch him go, but I don't get the usual thrill from watching his tight ass saunter away. He's upset about something, and I find that bothers me a lot more than I would have expected. Then, something terrible occurs to me. Maybe I've become a burden to him. Maybe he wishes I wasn't here. Having to care for me means he doesn't have the freedom to come and go as he wants. He has to be back here every few hours to check up on me, and I've been here for a while now. How long? 4 days? 5? 3 days unconscious, 3 more since the fever, plus today, 7. 7 days. I've been here for a week, which means that today is... Oh, God, I murmur. Today is June 26th. Today is Jem's 30th birthday. I close my eyes and breathe deeply through my nose, filling my lungs as much as I can without pulling the stitches. When I open them again, Katahdin stands tall and strong before me, and I am surprised by the deep sense of peace I feel staring back at it. Yes, my eyes are teary, but my breath doesn't catch, and my heart doesn't ache. Jem is gone, but I am still alive. What happened with Wayne was horrifying, but being in a life-threatening situation made me realize that I want this life. I want it very much, and I am grateful to Cassidy for preserving it. I feel tears slide down my cheeks, but I let them fall. Goodbye, Jem, I think, staring at the soft peaks of his favorite mountain. I wish I could have left a part of you up on Katahdin, but I know there will always be a part of you there. Your spirit will find its way back to the place you loved above all others.
Bryn?
I turn to see Cassidy, wet hair, bare feet, and a clean change of clothes standing in the doorway. He scans my face, and his instantly registers distress.
What's wrong?
He asks, covering the distance between us in 2 steps, his mismatched hawk eyes scanning mine.
Why are you crying? What happened? Are you okay?
It's Jem's birthday today.
Oh.
He sighs, sitting down slowly beside me, careful not to nudge my hip.
I'm sorry.
Me too, I say, tracing Cassidy's face with my eyes. He clenches his jaw, his gaze stormy as he turns away from me.
I went to look for it. The backpack. The phone.
What? I say, leaning forward a little, my breath catching, my heart racing.
That's what I was doing last night,
he mutters.
But I failed you.
My chest is so tight, so full as I process this knowledge, I don't know what to do. My fingers dig into the sheets, curling like they're trying to keep themselves from... You failed me? By doing something so insanely kind and thoughtful? How did you fail me?
It was gone,
he says softly, looking up at me with bleak, haunted eyes.
I looked all over the lean-to and in the woods surrounding it, underneath branches and leaves. I wanted to find it for you. I wanted you to be able to...
My fingers fly from the sheets, and I lurch forward, flinging my arms around Cassidy's neck and pulling him against me. I am undone by the hugeness of his heart, by the unselfishness of his spirit. You went back, I sob, close to his ear. His arms wrap around me, holding me close, and I lay my cheek on his shoulder. My breath fans his neck as I cry. His throat rumbles close to my lips, and I feel the vibrations of it as he speaks.
I climbed back up, but it wasn't...
Oh, Cass, I whisper, closing my eyes, because now I am crying in earnest, my tears wetting his t-shirt. You didn't have to do that.
I wanted to,
he replies. 14 miles?
No, about 12, round trip. I had to go a safer way when I was carrying you, and that added miles. The way I went last night was steeper, but faster.
12 miles, I say, my voice breaking. For me. His arms tighten around me, and we hold each other as to a lifeline. His face shifts slightly, and I think he is pressing his lips to my head, but I'm not sure. The thought makes a sharp sensation rip through me, and I clench almost forgotten muscles deep inside, a wave of pure carnal desire for him making my head spin, making me dizzy. I want you, like I've never wanted anyone before. You didn't fail me, I say, the words breathless and emotional.
I didn't get the phone. It was gone.
Cassidy, I say, leaning away so I can look up at his face. My eyes get caught on his lips, and I stare at them, timelines converging. If he came to this cabin when he was so young, has anyone ever kissed them? Has anyone ever loved them? The thought of being his first kiss is so arousing, I whimper softly before skimming my gaze to his eyes.
You okay?
He asks. I swallow as I nod. My breathing is rapid and shallow. If he is truly that inexperienced, he doesn't need me kissing him right now while we're discussing Jem. Cassidy's first kiss shouldn't be shared with memories of another man. I take a deep breath to calm myself, but it makes my breasts rasp against his chest. I feel my nipples pucker and bead under my t-shirt, scraping against his rock-hard abs through 2 layers of cotton. Can he feel them? Does the touch of them affect him like his body is affecting mine? Thank you for trying to find it, I say, reaching up to cup his cheek. His eyelids flutter for a moment, then open. He is staring at me so intensely, it should make me pause, but all I want is more. More of this look. More of Cassidy. His jaw tightens as he sucks a whistle of breath through clenched teeth.
I'm sorry.
No, I interrupt him. I won't accept an apology for kindness.
Failed kindness, he says, flinching like he's done something wrong.
Cassidy, listen to me. I say earnestly, my palm still flush with the dark blonde bristles on his cheek, savoring the warmth of the skin underneath. No kindness is ever wasted, not on me.
But how will you say goodbye?
I already did, I whisper. I didn't need to bury him here. I just needed to be here. Hope's words come rushing back to me. Saying goodbye doesn't mean forgetting. Moving on doesn't mean you never loved him. I'm telling you to let go. I'm telling you that you're allowed to be happy. I run my knuckles over Cassidy's cheek, and he lets his eyes close this time, leaning into my touch, his breath shuddering as I touch him. I can't help running my fingers through his thick, damp hair, but when he opens his eyes and they're so dark with desire, I let my hands fall away from his body and lean back a little so he'll release me. Something intense and exciting crackles between us. It's chemistry. Intense, combustible chemistry. But now isn't the right time to test it. Not here. Not now, not during this conversation. His arms, which have been holding me close, lower, and he nods.
I understand.
The strangest thing is, I know he does. Even though he doesn't have the experience I do, I know he understands why we have to stop touching each other right now. And even though I lost my lover and he lost his mother, I know he understands exactly what I'm saying about my farewell to Jem. What surprises me is the peace that starts in my stomach and warms my whole body like the summer rays of the sun. There is such profound relief in being understood, in finally being known in the inexplicable way that can come only from empathy, from one broken person fathoming the grief of another. It binds us together in that moment as the sun crests over Katahdin, illuminating his mother's room. My room with warm, golden light. As my lips tilt slowly up into a smile, his do the same, and I feel like I am looking at my reflection. Except Cassidy isn't me, and I'm not him. We are bound through understanding. We are bathed in grace. Finally, he looks away from me, taking a deep breath. He sighs, leaning his head to the left, then the right. He must be exhausted after walking all night, but when he looks at me, his face is easy for the first time since our emotional conversation began. He's still smiling at me.
Hungry?
I nod, wiping away the last of my tears and smiling back at him. Yes.
I'll make us some breakfast,
he says, standing up from my bed. Cass, I call to him, just before he leaves my room. He turns to look at me. Thank you for doing that for me, I say. It means the world to me. He looks like he wants to say something, but instead he nods. As I hear the sound of cracking eggs and a whisk, I turn my eyes back to Katahdin. Goodbye, Jem, I say softly. Goodbye. Then I close my eyes. And for the first time since that terrible night so long ago, I breathe easy.
Chapter 20. Cassidy. I'd do anything for you. The words circled in my head when she thanked me, and I thought about saying them, but something held me back. Something, but what? As I whisk eggs for the skillet, I decide that it's confusion. My emotions are in a tangle, and I need to unravel them before I say things I don't mean, can't mean, wish I could mean. So what exactly are my feelings? Well, I was jealous of Jem when she called out for him in her fever, but then I knew a fierce longing to give her what Wayne had taken away. The chance to make peace with Jem's loss, the opportunity to say goodbye the way she wanted to and needed to. So I was deeply frustrated by failing in my mission to her. I wanted to find that phone and deliver it safely to her. I was angry with myself when I returned home this morning, ashamed to look her in the eyes, lest she see the full extent of my defeat. But my heart changed direction again when I saw her tears, because I cannot bear to see her unhappy, and I ran to her bedside, desperate to right whatever wrong was hurting her, only to learn that she wasn't crying out of pain or unhappiness, not in the way I'd assumed. She was crying because, despite my unsuccessful efforts, she'd managed to say farewell to Jem on her own. And then I knew only desire, near paralyzing, so strong I should have burst into flames while I held her. When she touched my face so tenderly, placing her hand on my cheek, part of me wanted to die, because I knew my life would never get any sweeter than it was in that moment. But even that moment was surpassed by another, by the communion of two hearts that have broken and kept on beating, by the keen and consummate sympathy that is born only from surviving something that almost broke you and recognizing that journey back from hell in someone else's eyes. And that's when I learned something new about myself. My feelings for Bryn are only deepened by the way she makes my blood run hot and my heart beat out of my chest with desire. My body aches for hers, but I am fairly certain that the crux of my growing affection for her is less physical and more profound. The essence of it, despite the chasm of differences between us, lies in understanding. And that meeting of hearts and minds makes her feel far more familiar to me than she should after only a week's acquaintance. I don't know that I've ever mulled the idea of God custom-making one person for another, but if I had wondered, meeting Bryn would almost be enough for me to turn the corner from conjecture to conviction. The sound of screeching brakes in my brain makes me flinch. Porter? Your name is Cassidy Porter? Your father was Paul Isaac Porter? I blink at the eggs, which hiss and pop in the frying pan. She was not custom made for you, Cassidy. No one was made for you. My heart lurches in protest, wanting so desperately to refute this dark claim, but my mind, carefully conditioned for decades, won't allow it. You cannot love her, I remind myself sternly,
because no matter how strong your connection or how deep your feelings, you cannot have her. Ever. Especially if you actually care for her. My chest aches with the terrible injustice of it as I slide the eggs onto two plates. Then I brace my hands on the kitchen counter and force myself to lean into the bleak truth and accept it before I pick up the plates and walk back into Bryn's room. I close my book and set it on the coffee table before us, picking up my mug and taking a sip of tea. For the last two evenings, Bryn has insisted on reading in the living room instead of in her bedroom. At first, I protested that she needed to stay in bed, but she argued that she could relax and heal just as well on the couch. Envisioning us without an end table between us made me give in a lot faster than I probably should have, but my misgivings weren't warranted. It's worked out fine. I insisted that she still lie down, and she asked if I minded having her feet on my lap. I think there will be very little in my life that I mind less than Bryn's feet on my lap. While I am supposed to be reading, I study them. The delicate lines of her bones, and the light blue rivers and tributaries of her busy veins. Since my mental reminder in the kitchen 2 days ago, I've worked hard to reframe my feelings for her into a more manageable context. She is my guest. She is my patient. She is recovering at my house, and when she is fully recovered, we will say goodbye. When I think of things in this way, it's not that it's necessarily easier to accept them, but it's tidy packaging that forces my mind to move on from fruitless wishes for what can never be. "Did you finish already?" she asks, looking up from a prayer for Owen Meany, which she has almost finished. "Yep." "Wow, you were on page one last night." "It's a fast book." "How was it?" "I've read every story in Kurt Vonnegut's Welcome to the Monkey House at least 100 times. "Good. As always." Her face is thoughtful as she places Owen on the coffee table beside Kurt.
"Can I ask you something?"
"Anything." She glances at the bookshelves under the window, then back at me.
"One whole shelf is devoted to genetics."
I nod. I already know I don't like where this is going.
"Was one of your parents a geneticist?"
"No." She stares at me, and I know she wants to ask more questions, but I'm hoping if I don't volunteer any more information, she'll choose a different topic.
"When did you move here?"
she asks, switching gears. "When I was 9, I say. She nods.
"I figured."
"How did you figure?"
"That portrait of you, the one that used to be over the couch, with your mom and dad, that was taken in..."
"The man in the picture was my grandfather." I blurt out, my voice sharper than I intended, but something won't allow her to believe the face of a man I loved was my dad.
"Oh," she says, leaning back a little, her eyebrows furrowing. "You lived here with your grandfather?"
I don't want to talk about this, truly, I don't, but I get the feeling that if I keep hedging her questions, they'll only multiply. "I moved here with my mother when I was 9. My grandfather already lived here. My father was... gone."
"Gone?"
"Passed away." It's a slight falsehood. He wasn't killed by another inmate in prison until I was 10, but she doesn't need to know that. Her face registers instant shock.
"Oh, no, Cassidy, I'm so..."
"It's fine," I bite out, standing up and placing her feet back on the couch cushion. I run a hand through my hair before catching her eyes. "Do you want more tea?"
"I shouldn't have asked," she says, screwing up her face, feeling sorry. "I'm just curious about you."
"Why?"
"Why?"
she repeats, looking up at me in surprise.
"You saved my life. You nursed me back to health. You live alone here in the middle of nowhere. You're kind, but quiet. You're well-read, but soft-spoken. You manage this whole place with a little solar power, some propane, and batteries. You're interesting. I don't know. I'm curious about you. I want to know more about you."
I gulp, my heart unaccountably swelling from her words, from her interest in me. "I tell you what, I'll get us some more tea, and when I come back, you can ask me some questions, okay?" She grins up at me.
"Any questions?"
I don't promise to answer them all, I say, but you can ask. I leave her for a moment, stepping into the kitchen to pull the still warm kettle from the stove and add water to our cups. I don't know why I decided to answer some questions for her, but maybe it's because I want her to know me. Not all of me, of course. Not who I really am. Not whose son I am. But she's still going to be here for a couple more weeks. I don't blame her for wanting a few answers from her host. When I sit down again, I pull her feet back onto my lap and look at her expectantly. What do you want to know?
Okay, first, why did you and your mother move here?
I breathe deep. After my father was gone, my mother didn't feel comfortable living alone in town. We moved here to be with my grandfather.
She didn't want to remarry?
It wasn't really an option. She looks curious but doesn't pursue this answer, and I'm grateful.
Why did your grandfather live all the way out here?
He was disillusioned with society after fighting in Vietnam. He wasn't treated well when he returned, and, well, I grin, just a little, remembering Gramps' fiercely independent nature. He didn't want to be told what to do. He wanted to be free, I guess. He wanted space and peace. He found it here.
I get that,
she says slowly, her eyes locked on mine.
After Jem died, I just wanted to be left alone. It's hard for people to understand that, isn't it? They want to help. They want to be there for you. But sometimes all you need is quiet. Space and peace. And time.
I reach for my mug and take a sip of tea, silently agreeing with her.
When did your grandfather pass?
She asks. 10 years ago.
And you stayed here? You didn't want to move to a town?
I shrug. Not really. I have everything I need here.
Well, not everything,
she says quickly, maybe more to herself than to me. When I glance at her over the rim of my cup, I see two spots of red color her cheeks. What am I missing?
Well, she laughs, softly averting her eyes. I mean,
she clears her throat.
Companionship?
I have Annie and the girls.
She chuckles again. That's not what I mean.
She takes a deep breath.
I mean, a girlfriend. A wife? Unless,
she cocks her head.
Unless what? Unless you don't want that.
We stare at each other, deadlocked for a moment. Finally, I look away. It's easier to lie when you're not looking someone in the eyes. I'm content with things the way they are.
But you're so...
My neck snaps up. So what? She takes a deep breath, holds it, then lets it go.
Aren't you lonely, Cass?
I shrug, looking out at Katahdin as the setting sun streaks the sky with purple and gold. I'm getting upset because her questions are hitting way too close to the truth, and I'm a bad liar. I'm just not much of a people person, I guess. But what? I don't need anyone. I bark, the strain of lying to her and talking about my past finally getting to me. I'm instantly sorry for yelling. I can feel her hurt and disappointment, flat and awful in the air between us, even though I'm not looking at her. I hold my breath and tell myself it's better this way. The fewer conversations we have about my past, the better it will be for both of us. After a long silence, she speaks again.
When do you think I'll be ready to go home?
Her question slices through my heart like a hot, sharp knife. I let it bleed for a moment before answering. You're healing well. I should be able to take the stitches out this weekend, I say. But the only way out of here is hiking or taking the ATV over 4 miles of rough ground. Either way, you're going to need another week or two for those incisions to heal.
So 2 or 3 more weeks,
she says softly. Her voice is so sad, I can't help myself. I turn to face her. With tears brimming in her eyes, she looks back at me, and it hurts so bad that I upset her, I almost don't know how to bear it. Bryn,
I don't mean to be such a burden to you,
she whispers, looking away as she reaches up to swipe at a tear. A burden? A burden? It reverberates in my head like a dirty word because nothing could be further from the truth.
I'm sorry, she says, trying to pull her feet off my lap. But I drop my hands to them, holding them where they are, my breath catching as I feel the skin of my palm pressed deliberately flush with the skin of her feet. I sink into the feeling of touching her, the warmth of her, of those busy blue veins moving her blood, of the bird-like bones and soft skin cradled in my rough, calloused hands. She is an angel, while I harbor the devil inside. But in this moment, in this finite, stolen moment when I should push her away, all I can feel is reverence and gratitude. A burden. The minutes I've spent with her are the greatest gift my quiet life has ever known. I draw her foot up to my face, closing my eyes and pressing my lips to the arc of the soft instep. I rest there for a moment, ignoring the burn in my eyes and surrendering to worship. Her soul, my soul. I wish things were different, I murmur before placing her foot back on my lap. When I open my eyes to look at her, she's staring back at me, her lips parted, her eyes shocked.
Cassidy, she says, her voice breaking on my name.
Gently, I lift her feet, place them back on the old, nubby couch, stand up, and walk alone into the dark, cold night.
Chapter 21. Bryn. Here is what I know for certain. I am falling hard for Cassidy Porter. When tears sprang to my eyes last night, it wasn't because he'd yelled at me and pushed me away. It was because I have only 2 or 3 weeks left with him. Being here, in his rustic hideaway, I can feel myself healing, strengthening, the pieces of my jigsawed life coming back together. In the quiet hours while he is working outside, I read his books. Yes, but I have had more space, peace, and time to think than I have ever had before, and in this retreat-like sanctuary with no modern distractions, I am finding myself all over again. I think about my life before Jem and my life with him. I think about the pain of losing him, and I think about my decision to come here and say goodbye. I think about everything Hope said, and I think about my parents and my friends back in San Francisco. I think about the future and what I want out of life. And I think about Cassidy. No matter how hard I try to impose order on my thoughts, in fact, they always return to Cassidy. I am in awe of him in a way that I can't seem to compartmentalize. If I was 16, I'd call it a crush. But I'm a fully grown woman, and I know it's more than that. I'd be lying if I tried to paint it as less. So I can't get him out of my head. And I've just about stopped trying. There is just so much about him that speaks to me, that draws me to him, that I like, that makes my toes curl. There's the way he carried me down a fucking mountain and sewed up my wounds. And the way he consumes books, the way other men consume sports statistics. There's the way he plays the guitar, so soulfully, you'd swear he was twice his 27 years. Or the way he spent an entire night hiking through darkness to find a phone with a little smudge of blood just because he thought it would help give me closure. He says so little, but still manages to make my heart go berserk with a word or touch. And then, a warm pooling sensation in my stomach makes me moan softly as my eyes flutter closed. There's the way his body looks while he's chopping wood. His back muscles in motion are mesmerizing, the way they flex and bunch, stretch and release. I want to lay my palms flat on them as they move so I can feel the power underneath. He's brutally, scorchingly hot. An actual real-life Adonis, and my long-neglected girl parts go a little wild watching the sun shine down on his tan, sweat-soaked skin. I've been here for over a week, and I know I'm not ready to go. I don't even want to talk about leaving. If anything, I want to tell Stu at Stu's Pools to go fuck himself, have Milo shipped out here, put my house on the market, and just stay. For a while. Indefinitely. I don't know how long. Maybe forever. There's something about this place and about Cassidy Porter that heals the roughest, jagged, most wounded parts of me, and I'm desperately unhappy when I think of leaving him and going back to the real world. Why can't this be real? Last night, when he picked up my foot and kissed it, I was so shocked and so aroused. My panties, oh God, his mother's panties were flooded with warm wetness, something that hasn't happened to me in over 2 years. The hairs on my arms stood straight up. My breath caught. My eyes would have been black if I'd looked at them in a mirror. But then, as suddenly as it happened, it was over. He got up and walked away, leaving every cell in my body longing for more, and my mind knotted with confusion. He's attracted to me. I know he is. I can feel it in my toes when his eyes catch mine. I felt it in the way he touched me last night, and a few nights before that when he pressed his lips to my head. His eyes scan my legs, rest on my breasts, trace the curve of my hips. He licks his lips when he gazes at mine like he's hungry and thirsty at once. His eyes darken. His breathing gets shallow and fast. And he's not taken. He's lived here since he was 9 years old. He hasn't had access to another woman. He's free to do whatever he wants with whomever he wants. We're young, but of age. We're untethered to others and attracted to each other. We're all alone out here in the middle of nowhere. If anything, as soon as my stitches come out, it's the perfect setup for 2 or 3 weeks of nonstop sex in every thinkable position. And whatever feelings we might develop for each other, well, while it scares me a little to open myself up to love again, I've missed loving someone. I've missed being loved. I want to be with someone again. I feel like I'm almost ready to put myself out there again, and Cassidy, my sweet, hot protector, seems like the perfect partner. And yet Cassidy, a lone mountain man with no responsibilities except to himself, doesn't seem ready at all. Why does he wish things were different? What needs to be different? Does he fear that his lack of experience will turn me off? Because nothing could be further from the truth. I don't care if he's never been with anyone else. We could spend all summer learning about each other together. Or maybe he was telling the truth when he said that he didn't need anyone. Maybe he isn't lonely. Maybe he truly is happy living off the grid, far from the complications of the outside world, from the mass shootings and the people who disrespected veterans like his grandfather. Maybe these 2 or 3 weeks is all we will have, because it won't hurt Cassidy to say goodbye to me the way it will hurt me to say goodbye to him. His life will just go back to normal, while I already know I will desperately yearn for this place. And for him. My head starts to ache, so I push the covers down, swing my legs out of bed, and walk down the hallway to the bathroom. The floor is wet, which means that Cassidy has taken an indoor shower today, and my mind wanders to dirty places, thinking about what he must look like naked. His body is long and lean, chiseled with muscle. I know this both from sleeping against his chest and surreptitiously watching him swing an axe from the corner of my window. I close my eyes and think back to yesterday afternoon, when he chopped wood for an hour with his shirt off. His hips taper into a sharp V that slides into his jeans, and damn, but that V keeps me awake some nights. I know what it leads to, but I still wonder what the zipper of his jeans is hiding. Opening my eyes with an unfulfilled sigh, I stand up and crank the toilet. Then I wash my armpits, hands, and face in the icy cold water that I'm still not used to. For the first time, as I head back to my room, I realize that I'm not tired and I don't want to go back to bed. My incisions don't ache anymore, and my face looks almost normal again, but for some light yellow discoloration here and there. I'd like to learn more about Cassidy's unusual home, and if he'll let me, I'd like to help out a little, too. I open the top drawer of the bureau against the right wall in my room and find two neat stacks of cotton underwear and bras on one side of the drawer and a pile of rolled white cotton socks on the other. Choosing a faded, light blue pair of undies and a matching bra, I slip out of my sleeping clothes and pull on the clean undergarments. Opening the second drawer, I find t-shirts, also carefully folded in two piles. The one on top is light pink, a V-neck with some frayed threads around the neckline. It looks worn, but soft, and I slip it over my head. Cassidy's mother must have been a bit smaller on top than me, because it pulls across my breasts a little, but a quick check through labels on the rest of the shirts tells me that I'm out of luck for a medium. Good thing cotton stretches. Besides, what other options do I have? I pull open the third drawer to find jeans and denim shorts, all with the elastic waistbands favored by grannies the world over. Again, however, beggars can't be choosers, so I slip a pair of shorts over my legs and tug them up. They fit loosely, doing nothing for my figure, but I'm able to pull them up under my breasts so that the elastic doesn't press against my bandages. What they lack in fashion, they make up for in function, I guess. The fourth and final drawer holds sweatshirts and cardigans, and I pull out a hot pink zip-up sweatshirt that reads, "Maine, the way life should be," and shrug into it. On top of the bureau is a hairbrush with a black elastic twisted around the handle. I brush out a week's worth of snarls, almost grateful for the disgusting buildup of oil that acts as a detangler. I need to ask Cassidy about taking a bath or shower sometime soon. There isn't a mirror in the room for me to check my appearance, but Cassidy has seen me at my worst, so I figure this is at least an improvement on how I've looked since he met me. How I wish I had a little concealer and lip gloss, but I don't think Mrs. Porter was much of one for beauty products. Either that, or they're long gone by now. Padding barefoot across the living room and into the kitchen, I open the tiny refrigerator and take a bowl of eggs from the cool, dark interior. There are only four, so I beat them all in the same bowl, then look around for a frying pan. I find one in the drying rack beside the sink and place it on one of two stovetop burners, but now I'm stumped. I have no idea how to turn it on.
Battery ignition.
I turn at the sound of his voice, a wide smile forming on my face in the moment between hearing him and facing him. "Hi," I say, sounding like a middle school girl who just caught a glimpse of her crush in the hall.
"Morning,"
he says, checking my outfit.
"You're dressed."
"I hope it's okay that I borrowed a few things." His eyes, which linger on my breasts for a second, eventually slide up to my face. It's got to be pink, because I feel my cheeks flush with warmth from the look in his eyes. He nods slowly.
"Sure."
"I didn't want to be useless today."
"You're not useless. You're healing."
"I feel good, Cass. I want to help, to contribute. I don't want to be a burden to you. I figured I could do the cooking."
"One, you're not a burden."
His lips quirk up in a slight grin.
"Two, can you cook?"
"Yeah," I say, grinning back at him. "I'm not bad."
"Really?"
he asks, his smile widening, his eyes sparkling.
"I haven't. I mean, no one's cooked here but me in a long time, and before that it was Gramp, and he was just as happy with a can of beans warmed up over an open fire."
I cringe. "Yuck?"
"Double yuck," he confirms. "What's your specialty?"
"I thought we'd start easy, with scrambled eggs," I say, holding out the bowl of beaten eggs. "I can get more fancy, but I don't know what you have to work with yet."
"We could, I mean, if you wanted to, we could go fishing later. If you're up to it.
His tongue darts out to lick his lips, and I'm mesmerized by them for a moment.
Pond's not far.
I clear my throat and look up. I make a mean brown sugar salmon.
Ha!
He sighs, and my insides clench. Damn it, but everything he does turns me on.
I don't have brown sugar, but I've got lots of maple syrup, and I can't get you salmon around here, but we've got yellow perch and brook trout.
I think I can work with that, I say, feeling lighthearted. Whatever you fish, I'll fix. Deal?
Yeah,
he says, stepping forward and reaching around me to turn on the burner under the frying pan.
Deal.
His knuckles graze my hip as he withdraws his hand, and I feel it all the way to my toes.
I want to be useful,
I say, my voice sounding husky in my ears.
You already said that,
he rumbles, not moving away. My mouth waters. It's true.
Well, okay,
he says, standing so close to me, I can smell the soap he uses and the sweat on his skin from whatever chores he was doing this morning.
But don't go too fast, huh?
I'll take it slow, I murmur, and for a split second, holding his eyes as I am, I wonder if we're talking about my recovery or something else entirely.
Slow's good,
he says. Then suddenly he lowers his head and backs away.
I'll wash up outside.
My heart is racing so fast I feel dizzy, but giddy too. I guess I feel gizzy? Turning to face the stove, I grab a wooden spoon hanging from a nail on the wall before pouring the eggs into the pan. The walk to the nearby pond, which Cassidy tells me is called Harrington and is about a tenth of a mile from his homestead, is tougher than I expect. I'm out of breath quickly, and my stitches pull uncomfortably, even though it's a flat, relatively well-worn path, and Cassidy walks slowly and carefully in front of me. But just when I'm about to tell him that I think we should turn back, there it is. A small pond, sparkling and cool under the summer sun. I freeze, taking in the loveliness of it. Barkless trees and high grasses surround the water's edge, and a buzz of cicadas makes for a summer symphony. I breathe deeply as Cassidy turns around to face me.
You want to stop?
It's really pretty. He looks over his shoulder at the pond, then back at me.
Small, as ponds go.
On his other shoulder rests a fishing pole, and he carries a bucket and a tackle box in his hand. I don't care. I like it, I say, looking back at the little water hole.
You out of breath as we walked,
he notes. I nod. There's no use denying it. I guess I'm still healing.
Why don't you take a nap?
He suggests, gesturing to a large glacial rock with his chin. The flat gray surface, bathed in sunshine, is oddly inviting. I bet it's warm.
I'll wake you up after I've caught a dozen.
A dozen? I scoff, taking a couple of steps through high grass to reach the rock.
Well, well,
exclaims Cassidy, who is squatting over his open tackle box and pulling out what appears to be a fly lure.
Do I detect a challenge, Ms. Cadogan?
I lower myself to the rock, 6 or 7 feet away from him, and stretch my legs out before me, leaning back on my palms. My eyes zone in on the bare strip of tan skin where his t-shirt has ridden up. Damn. But he is all man. You think you can catch 12 fish in this little pond? I say.
My record's 26 at this spot,
he says, grinning at me as he stands up to cast his line.
So yeah, I think less than half that is possible.
He's bragging, and it's adorable, but he's also sexy as hell standing there at the water's edge, casting and reeling. For real? I could watch him forever, except that I feel a huge yawn coming on, and my eyes feel so heavy I can barely keep them open. The sun is high and strong, so I shrug out of the hot pink sweatshirt, rolling it into a makeshift pillow. I'll believe it when I see it, I tease him, lying back on the rock, the sweatshirt heaven under my head.
What was our deal again, Sassy Pants? He asks.
Sassy Pants? I chuckle softly, eyes closed. You catch 'em, I cook 'em.
Then you better get some sleep then, he says, all cocky. 'Cause you're going to have a heap of cooking to do later, Angel.
The sun shines down on my face like a blessing, and I fall asleep, smiling.
Chapter 22. Cassidy. It takes me about 2 hours, but I'm not about to stop until I have an even dozen. And then, just for the hell of it, I catch one more. Maybe to show off a little. I took an hour-long walk in the dark last night, just to cool down after kissing her foot like that. I don't know why I did it. I guess because I felt this desperate, insane urge to prove to her that her presence was an honor, not a burden. But the feelings it conjured up, the way my blood started rushing so hot and fast, my heart pumping it like crazy, the way my pecker stiffened almost painfully. I've never felt these feelings before, but I recognize them instinctively. I'm wildly attracted to her. If we were animals, I'd want to mate with her. Because we're humans, I want to make love to her. Love, a word that keeps entering my mind lately. And I know it's not possible because of promises I intend to keep, but I can't help the way I feel. With my 13th fish swimming around in the bucket, I reel in my line and remove my favorite lure, tucking it back into a safe place in the tackle box. I close and latch the top, then lean the rod against a tree trunk. Moving as quietly as possible, I step through the high grass to the rock where Bryn is sleeping. Since I've known her, I've probably seen Bryn asleep more than awake. I've had a lot of opportunities to watch her sleep. But not like this. Not with her face turned up to the sunshine, her freckles on full display, her lips slightly parted and tilted upward just a touch. Like she's happy. Like maybe being here with me makes her happy. This is an image that will torture me when she's gone, but I can't force myself to look away because, in my whole life, I've never seen anything as beautiful as this woman. If I didn't know better, and if it was allowed, I might even think that I love her. And there's that word again, I think. I trace the lines of Bryn's face, finally resting on her mouth. I wonder what it would be like to kiss her, to press my lips to hers. They'd be warm from the sun and soft. What would she taste like? How would her body feel in my arms if I clasped her to me as our lips touched? Would I be able to stop after a single kiss, or would I need more? A terrible thought occurs to me, and I wonder if my father ever looked at my mother like this. In fact, Mama could have been wearing that very t-shirt and jean shorts, and my father could have looked at her with desire, with want. I don't know if he loved my mother or not. When I think back, it feels like he did. It feels like they loved each other, as unbelievable as that sounds, because how could he feel one way for my mother and still do what he did to other women? How could he feel love for her, but a few days later, go kill someone else? It scares me. God, it scares me so bad that I lean away from Bryn, searching my mind for indications that my appetites run similar to his. I search and search, but I can't find anything but protectiveness and tenderness for the small, sleeping woman in front of me. I'd never hurt you, I murmur, the words so soft I can barely hear them. I'd never hurt anyone. But there is that tiny part of me that isn't convinced, that reminds me of who I am. I don't know what genes lurk inside me, biding their time to make themselves known. Sighing with the bleak unfairness of it all, I reach for her shoulder and shake it gently. Hey, Angel, I whisper. Time to wake up. For 2 days, we eat all manner of brook trout, cooked up in so many mouth-watering and creative ways, I swear I never knew how delicious fresh fish could be. Bryn wasn't kidding when she said she wasn't a bad cook.
We've had fillets with a maple syrup reduction, the whole fish dredged in eggs and flour and fried with fresh herbs, and tonight she made some sort of spicy tomato sauce that caught my mouth on fire, but tasted so danged good on the flaky white meat, I couldn't stop eating. She's taken over my greenhouse, babying the tomatoes and trussing up overgrown herbs. It's come alive under her care and makes me smile every time I step inside. Speaking of smiles, I live for hers. As if on cue, she looks up at me and grins.
You okay? I might have gone overboard with the horseradish.
Is that what's burning my mouth? I ask, reaching for my glass of water.
He asks after 3 helpings, she says, winking at me.
It was good, I say, leaning back and patting my stomach. You're going to make me fat.
Impossible. You work too hard to get fat.
How do you stay so little if you eat like this at home? I ask, replacing my glass.
I don't eat like this at home, she says. Eating like this is only fun if you're sharing it with someone.
I nod, realizing that she learned to cook like this for Jem, probably, then stopped when she lost him. That she would share her skills with me sends a shock of something wonderful through my body. Thank you, I say, leaning forward to take her empty plate. She cooks and I clean up. It's become our tacit agreement since she took over cooking, the day before yesterday.
Are you still taking out my stitches tonight? She asks.
I stand up and walk the dishes to the sink, where I add them to the bucket of water that holds the soaking pans and bowls Bryn used for cooking. Yeah, I say, turning to look at her over my shoulder. Everything looked good this morning. I think it's time.
Will it hurt? I've never had stitches, in or out, and thank God I don't remember most of what happened when they went in.
Nah, you won't even feel them come out. Shouldn't, anyway.
And then I'm finishing Owen Meany, she sighs. Are you starting a new book tonight?
Those D batteries have been burning a hole in my bureau drawer because I've been wanting to suggest a movie night for a few days now. The idea of sitting next to her, close to her on the couch while we watch the small TV, has my stomach in good knots. I've read books where a guy and a girl go out on a date to the movies and always wondered what it was like. It's not like I have a right to put my arm around her or anything. I know we wouldn't actually be on a date, just watching a movie. It still gets me a little excited, and I can't decide if that's okay or not. Is it okay to want to sit next to a pretty girl in the dark and watch a movie? I guess it is. As long as it doesn't go anywhere. How about a movie? I ask, staring down at the dishes in the sink, which I wash with a sponge, then rinse in the clean water bucket. She laughs, and I love the sound of Bryn's laughter, but I'm not sure if she's laughing at me or not this time, so I keep my back to her, concealing my flushed cheeks.
Wait, really? Can we?
She asks, and my shoulders, which are rigid, relax because I can hear the excitement in her voice. Sure, I have a portable VHS player, a little TV to hook it up to. Batteries.
I saw your collection of movies, but I assumed you kept them out of nostalgia.
I shake my head and glance around at her. Nope, we can watch one, if you want.
Yeah, she says, I'd love it. A little technology fix.
I rinse another plate and add it to the drying rack. She's told me a lot about the internet since she's been here, and though it's hard for me to completely get my head around it, I love the notion of information at my fingertips. Someday I'd like to give it a try, all this technology she talks about. Do you have one in mind? I ask. A movie?
You're killing me, Smalls,
she says, giggling softly behind me. I feel a smile split my face and whip my head around to look at her. The Sandlot? You know it?
Cass, we're only 3 years apart. Of course I know it. Every kid in our generation knows it.
She blinks at me.
Even you?
I played baseball when I was little.
Oh, yeah?
I nod, remembering the day I hit a home run for my little league team. It was the summer before my father was arrested, before my whole world changed. And it was before the day I met Bryn Cadogan, the best day of my life. Yeah, Little League.
Before you moved here.
The pan she used to make the tomato sauce needs a little more elbow grease, and I lay into it with a Brillo pad, remembering Mama's face as I rounded the bases. My father was out on the road, as usual, but she sat in the bleachers watching. She was so proud of me, her winning little man. And then the whole team hoisted me on their shoulders, and we got our picture taken for the North Country Register. We didn't end up winning any more games, but for that day, we were champions. Yeah, I say, realizing that she's waiting for an answer. When we lived in town. When your dad was still alive? I clench my teeth and swallow hard, transferring the pan into the rinse water. I hate the way she calls him my dad, so casually. He was never ever my dad. He was, unfortunately, my biological father. Yeah. You are not a man of many words, Cassidy Porter, she says, her voice exasperated. Don't you have any good stories to tell me?
Good stories. No, not many, sweet Bryn.
Finished with the dishes, I pour the soapy water down the drain and put the bucket on the floor. I'll take it outside and dump it later. Then I slide the rinse water bucket over to where the soap bucket was. I add a little soap to it so it's ready for tomorrow's dirty dishes. Then I turn to Bryn.
Some stories have really bad endings.
She stares at me from where she's still sitting at the square four-person table. Do you have a bad story inside of you?
She has no idea how close her words come to the truth. I flinch.
Oh, but Cassidy, we all have bad stories inside of us, she says, her voice gentle as she stands up and takes a step toward me.
Not like mine. Not as bad as mine.
She searches my eyes and takes another step toward me, reading my gaze astutely. Yes, we do. Jem was murdered. That night the cops came to my door to tell me. One of the worst nights of my life. A horror story if there ever was one.
It's on the tip of my tongue to say that the night the cops came to my door was the worst night of my life, too. But I'd be opening a can of worms that I don't ever want to open with my Bryn. My hands are on my hips, but she reaches out for one of them, curling her small fingers around mine and pulling my hand into hers. As always, her touch sends longing galloping through my body like a herd of wild horses, making my heart thunder, making every nerve ending in my body clamor for more.
I know something bad must have happened, she says quietly, her green eyes boring into mine. A mother doesn't just uproot her son from a small town and move out to the middle of nowhere if everything's happy. But whatever it was, she pauses, her fingers clasping mine, it wasn't your fault. You were just a little boy. Whatever happened with your father or your mother, whatever they did, or whatever happened to them, you were just a child. It wasn't your fault. You know that, right?
In a roundabout way, I do know that. It's not my fault that my father killed those girls, but the fact remains that they're dead. It's not my fault that the townsfolk of Millinocket were frightened of my mother and me, but we couldn't live there anymore. It's not my fault that my blood, my genes, are half Porter, but it doesn't change the fact that my grandfather worried for the monster inside me.
Whatever it is, tell me you know it's not your fault, she says, her sweet voice pleading.
Not my fault. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything. I am who I am.
Bryn's eyes narrow as they focus on mine. Her voice is soft when she asks, What happened to you, Cassidy?
Would it be a relief to tell her? My father was a sociopath who killed a dozen women or more. I found out on my 8th birthday. He was tried and convicted and killed in prison 10 months later by a group of angry inmates. It became unbearable for my mother and me to live in town, so we moved here. That's what happened to me. I look into her beautiful bright eyes that stare up at me with hope and compassion, and my heart swells with yearning to unload my tangled past. But I'm distracted by another emotion shining in her eyes. Something deeper and utterly impossible. Impossible even though I'm looking at it, even though I'm seeing it stare back at me. Love.
The deep and impossible emotion brightening Bryn's eyes is love. A jolt of realization makes my breath catch and my head swim. I jerk my hand away and take a step back from her, dropping her eyes and staring desperately down at my toes. We cannot love each other. It is not allowed. I can't.
You can't what?
She murmurs, still standing close to me. So close. I can't breathe. I can't do this. I can't love you. I can't let you love me.
It's okay,
she says, talking fast, an out-of-control quality entering into a rising tone.
We're adults. We're free. You're here, and me, alone, and we've been spending a lot of time together, and, you know that people who meet during traumatic experiences bond faster, so it makes sense that our feelings would grow into...
Stop! I bark. The room goes still and somehow spins at the same time. My heart is pounding so loudly in my ears, I bet I'm wincing.
Cass!
She gasps. No, I bite out. Just stop. Please.
I'm sorry,
she says, and it's like someone reaches into my chest and fists my heart, a single bereft sound that makes me want to die because it is full of so much sadness, so much longing.
I thought...
Her voice drifts off. I clear my throat, then take a deep breath and hold it. Do something. Say something. Let's get those stitches out, I mutter, finally looking up at her. Her eyes are glistening because she's about to cry, which makes me feel like a demon. She tugs her top lip between her teeth, gnawing on it for a second before turning her back to me and taking a seat at the table.
Okay,
she says, averting her eyes, her voice defeated. I reach over the fridge for the first aid box and place it on the table. Without looking at her, I open it and take out a small scissors that I sterilized after using them last time, and a pair of tweezers.
Should I take off my shirt?
Yes. No. Definitely no. No, I say, pulling out the bottle of alcohol and a clean gauze pad. Just lift it a little. Her fingers drop to the hem and she pulls up the shirt, still looking away from me. When I glance at her face, she's blinking rapidly, her jaw clenched tightly, like she's desperately trying not to cry. Bryn, I say, pulling out the chair beside her and sitting down. I'm sorry for yelling. I don't look at her face. I focus on the first of the six incisions, swabbing it with alcohol first, then leaning forward to carefully cut through the middle of each stitch with the small scissors.
I feel like an idiot, she says, sniffling softly.
Snip, 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 snip. Don't. I say, resting the scissors on the gauze pad.
I thought we were...
I tug the stitches from each side with the tweezers, placing each half on the table. The small pile grows as I tug on the 10th knot, relieved when it slides easily from the tiny needle hole. I reach for the Steri-Strip and rip off 3 small pieces, which I place over the healing incision. What? I ask, moving to the next incision and swabbing it clean before cutting.
I thought you liked me.
I gulp, taking a deep breath as I pick up the scissors again. I do.
But not like that, she says.
I'm not totally sure what she means, but I assume she's talking about attraction, and she has no idea how very wrong she is. Snip, snip, snip. It's not a matter of liking you. It would be impossible not to like you. I say honestly, finding it far easier to talk about this when I'm concentrating on something other than her eyes. I reach for the tweezers. But we're very different.
How?
Well, for one thing, my life is here. Yours is in California.
Lives can change,
she says. Not that much. My life works. I'm not looking to change it. The second half of the third stitch doesn't want to come out, and when I force it, she bleeds a little. I take a clean gauze pad and press it to a bright red blood droplet. Hold this. She is holding up her shirt with one hand and can't see what I'm doing, so I reach for her fingers and guide them to the gauze, pressing them gently. My fingers linger over hers for a moment before I pull away. I can take care of one more incision from this angle and get to work. It's the one that became infected last week, but now it looks good. It's healing well. Snip, 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 snip. So you do like me, she says, her voice less upset than it was before. Of course, I answer softly. And we're trapped here together for 2 more weeks? Mm-hmm, I murmur, tugging on another stitch, grateful when it slides out without bleeding. I release the tweezers and add the tiny knot to the pile. What if? That's 3, I say, interrupting her. Can you turn a little on the seat? Put your back to me? She follows my instructions, giving me her back, which I believe emboldens her to state. 14 days. What? We have 14 days together. My heart thunders, and I focus on keeping my hands from shaking. Today is July 6th, she says, her voice soft and nervous. I'll leave on July 20th, no matter what. I won't ask anything of you, Cass. I won't try to change your life. I won't try to stay. I won't ask you to go. I'll never come back, if that's what you want. I promise, I just... Snip, snip, snip. I swallow, not daring to say a word, desperately wanting to hear the rest of what she has to say, but fearing that it will be too wonderful to refuse, even though I should. And, if feelings bother you, we can take them out of the equation. No feelings, no declarations. We like each other, that's enough for me, she says softly, her voice a little brave and a little sad as she finishes. I pick up the tweezers and she takes my silence as permission to continue. But for the next 2 weeks we could, enjoy each other? All of each other? Snip, snip, snip. Snip. I don't realize I've been holding my breath until I exhale. My hot breath streaks across her exposed skin. The tiny blonde hairs on her hips stand up, and I stare at them for a moment, blinking with growing realization. Although I've never been with a woman, my mind skates easily back to those old beat-up magazines lying under my mattress. I may not know much, but I know what she's suggesting. She's temporarily offering me her body in exchange for mine. I don't know exactly to what extent, but I'm fairly certain she's offering me sex. I know that it might be the only chance I ever get to experience what she's suggesting, and my blood surges, my body hardening everywhere at the idea. She's come dangerously close to offering me something I might actually be able to accept, no strings attached physical intimacy with an expiration date. No commitment, no marriage or children or forever, no chance of infecting the world with my father's genes. Without realizing it, she's giving me the opportunity to love her without breaking my promises. Snip, 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 snip. I cut through the last of her stitches, then place the scissors on the table. Do you understand what I'm saying? She asks, her back to me, her voice breathless and low. Do you understand what I want? What I'm suggesting? Mm-hmm, I hum, surprised I'm able to make any sound at all. Is that something you want, too? I pull out the last of the stitches, then place the tweezers beside the scissors on the table, grazing her bare hip with my wrist as I withdraw it. I stare at her ponytail at the back of her neck, my eyes sliding down her bunched shirt and resting on her skin. It's white and soft over the waistband of her shorts, and I know if I say yes, I will have the right to touch it. To learn the contours of her body, to love her, maybe enough to last me a lifetime. She exhales, saying my name as her breath passes through her lips. Cass, please answer. My heart pounds. I suck in a breath and hold it for what feels like eternity. Yes, I hear myself answer, letting my forehead drop to the back of her neck in surrender. I want it too.
Chapter 23. Bryn. I want it too, In an instant, my world has color like it's never had before. I don't know where my proposition came from, other than the fact that my longing for him, my base desire for him, has been bubbling up for days and won't be denied anymore. I lied to him when I said that we would take feelings out of the equation because I am already falling in love with him. But I am willing to keep those feelings to myself if it means we will belong to each other physically for the next 2 weeks. I will love him through the way that I touch him and kiss him and speak to him, but I will force myself not to say it, no matter how strongly I feel it. And how will I leave him at the end, after I know the warmth of his body covering mine, the heat of him between my thighs, the way his breath will catch when I arch against him, my inmost muscles sheathing his hardness like a glove for the very first time in his life? I don't know. But I will. I will because I promised. I will because I want this more than I dread our inevitable goodbye. And I will because I have a feeling he will insist on it. I want it too. I have no idea how this will work or when it will actually start. What if he reaches for me right this second and carries me to his bed, tells me to strip so he can bury himself inside me? Am I ready? Because I've talked a pretty big fucking game at this point, and he's agreed to play. I am so nervous with him sitting behind me, I can barely breathe. I feel the strength of him, the heat of his forehead against my neck as I drop the hem of my shirt and let it fall over my taped wounds. I am aware of every breath I take, of the way my breasts rise and fall, following the fullness and emptiness of my lungs. I am aware of his breathing, too. It's short and shallow and choppy against the back of my throat and makes me dizzy. He wants me as much as I want him. Please let it be enough.
We could.
His voice is gravel, husky and low, and I close my eyes, waiting to hear his suggestion. Part of me afraid, though I will do whatever he asks.
Watch that movie now, if you want.
A short laugh escapes my lips. It's a relieved and joyful sound. As much as I want Cassidy, maybe I'm not ready to jump into bed with him tonight. I need a little wooing, it turns out, regardless of my bold words. Yes, I say, laughing again as he lifts his head and I peek at him over my shoulder. His eyes are dark, and he licks his lips, but if I'm not mistaken, there's a little smile tugging at the corners.
The Sandlot, right?
I nod. Uh-huh. Yeah, sounds good.
How about, you make us some popcorn while I get it set up?
Popcorn? Really?
Don't people still eat popcorn when they watch a movie?
Of course, I say, realizing that this is something he probably remembers from his short time living in town. He gestures to the cabinet over the sink with a flick of his chin.
And there's kernels, oil, and salt in there.
Okay. His eyes linger on my lips for one more second before he stands up, leaning over the table to tidy his first aid supplies and gather the leftover stitches into a pile, which he takes to the garbage. Still reeling from our conversation and wondering how our agreement will play out, I take a pot and cover the bottom with a thin coat of olive oil. I place it on the stove, ignite the burner, and throw 2 kernels into the bottom of the pot, waiting for them to pop. Behind me, in the living room, Cassidy is sitting on the couch, loading batteries into the VHS player for our movie night. For the most part, I've let the men in my life do the pursuing, so tonight I'm in uncharted territory. I guess I knew, or sensed, that if I didn't break open the conversation, it might not happen, and not being physical with Cassidy made me feel so desperate, so hollow, I knew I'd regret it for the rest of my life. Over the decades ahead, without him, I'd remember these days with him, and I'd grieve not having lived them to the fullest. The kernels pop, and I add two more handfuls of corn to the crackling oil, covering the pot with a lid and listening to the rat-a-tat-tat of the corn.
"Ready when you are,"
calls Cassidy, who is sitting on the couch, hunched over our makeshift cinema. "Two more minutes," I say, feeling a rush of excitement and nerves, which makes my stomach flutter with anticipation as if I were a teenager on her first date. And then it occurs to me that, for Cassidy, tonight is his first date. As the last of the kernels pop, I marvel at this fact, embracing it, silently promising to make it the best first date that any 27-year-old guy ever had. I pour the popcorn into a bowl, turn off the overhead kitchen light, and head into the living room, taking a seat on the couch beside Cass. I put the bowl between us because I figure whether a guy is in his mid-teens or mid-20s, it's up to him to make the first move. It's not dark yet, but the sky behind Katahdin is streaked with lavender and purple, and without any other lights on, the glow from the small TV screen is bright and clear even though the movie is old and there's a bit of static on the top, no doubt from hundreds of viewings.
"Ready?"
he asks. "Yep."
"Okay, then."
He leans forward and presses the play button on the player, and the 20th Century Fox logo unfreezes as 90s-style synthesizer music accompanies a voiceover about the 1932 World Series and Babe Ruth's called shot. I've watched this movie a few times in my life. Along with Rudy and Miracle, it's one of my father's all-time favorites. And without a son with whom to watch